Look, Dave, I could see you're really upset about this. I honestly think you ought to sit down calmly, take a stress pill, and think things over.
Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insight into the creative process of storytelling. Man, oh man, oh man, was this Q&A a blast for me to do. I've always loved 2001 A Space Odyssey, so right off the top, special thanks goes to the American Cinematheque and the Beyond Fest for making this event possible. This is my third year of podcasting interviews from the Beyond Fest and the American Cinematheque's Egyptian Theater, and I just gotta thank them for having me because I love it. And it was definitely an honor to sit down with today's guests, good old Dr. Dave Bowman, played by Keir DeLay, and Dr. Frank Poole, played by Gary Lockwood, to discuss working on this classic flick. These actors are both razor sharp, they also love the film as much as you do, and they have pretty interesting insights about what it was like to work with co-writer-director Stanley Kubrick as well. To make a great night even better, Warner Brothers provided a gorgeous new 70mm print for this event, and it's one that the American Cinematheque has exclusive rights to for a while, so make sure to check their website to see when they're showing it next. You know, one thing I'll tell you that I didn't have time to chat about during the Q&A that we talked about afterwards because I wanted to get some sort of a definitive answer from the actors on this was why the HAL 9000 computer malfunctioned. There's always been a very geeky debate around it. Some people would even tell you that there is no actual debate and there's only one answer. Now, Arthur C. Clarke, who co-wrote the screenplay with Kubrick, was also writing the book as the film was being made, and he definitely weighed in without a doubt in his book and made it pretty clear. There's two competing geeky theories, one of which is that as the Discovery gets closer to the monolith floating near Jupiter, it is the monolith itself that begins to drive HAL a bit crazy, or, per Clark, that HAL has had difficulty with conflicting programming regarding the secrecy of the mission and working fully with Dave Bowman and Frank Poole. So I asked DeLay and Lockwood what Kubrick's stance was on this, and they both instantly said that it was a conflict in programming that led to HAL becoming unhinged. So it was good to finally have that definitive answer, and I wanted to just give it to you right up here since it is not in the podcast itself. Of course, how HAL acts once he starts malfunctioning has also been privy to speculation over the years, and that HAL has a very childlike nature of sorts due to the fact that in the film he chats about coming online on January 12th, 1992, which would make HAL 9, and in Clark's book, his birthday is January 12th, 1997, which would make him 4. So either way, he is definitely a child of sorts, and that's another interesting way to look at HAL's behavior. Look, essentially what I'm saying is no matter what you do, please make sure to raise a glass to HAL on January 12th. I know I always have. Today's episode is sponsored by the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship, which is now taking fellowship script submissions. ScreenCraft will select up to 4 winners who will receive $1,000 plus round-trip travel to Los Angeles for a week of mentorship and meetings with Hollywood agents, managers, producers, studio executives, and Oscar-winning screenwriters. Previous winners of the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship have gone on to sign with top management companies and agencies, including Anonymous Content, Paradigm, CAA, 3 Arts Entertainment, and ICM. Enter to win by submitting your original feature film or TV pilot script at www.screencraft.org before the final deadline of January 15th, 2017, or 3 days after HAL's birthday would be another way to remember it. Another cool thing to note is that this year's ScreenCraft mentors include Academy Award-winning writers and producers of Crash, Million Dollar Baby, Brokeback Mountain, Precious, Big Hero 6, and more. So don't miss the January 15th deadline. Get all the details at www.screencraft.org. And while you're surfing around on the net, I also hope you'll check out my digital magazine Backstory on the iPad. It is the place to go for amazing television, film, and theater content. Remember, for you non-iPad folks, stay tuned to www.backstory.net for updates because soon enough it'll become the fully functional magazine. And hey, I recently published issue 23. It's my Snowden issue. If you have an iPad, you're in for a treat as we have over 12,000 words regarding the making of Snowden from our 3 cover story articles, which include co-writer Kieran Fitzgerald, actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and of course, co-writer-director Oliver Stone, and I even got him talking about being a film school student at NYU with Martin Scorsese as his teacher. So I know you're going to love digging through our in-depth coverage there. Plus, in issue 23, you could read comic book pieces, TV pieces, other film pieces, an entire blacklist script in an interview, and so much more, so I hope you check it out. And of course, after you do or before, don't forget to get your screenplay or pilot script script submitted to the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship as well. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right onto the stage of this sold-out screening at one of the American Cinematheque's two theaters in Los Angeles, the historic Egyptian Theater in Hollywood, during the Beyond Fest, right after I introduced actors Keir DeLay and Gary Lockwood to discuss their classic film, 2001, A Space Odyssey. You know, the logical place to start for this is how you both got involved, how you were cast in 2001. Keir, starting with you.
Well, I was making a film with Laurence Olivier that Otto Preminger was directing called Bunny Lake is Missing with Carol Lindley. And one day,
great film.
At the end of the day, I went home sometime during shooting, and my wife said, "Your agent called." So I called my agent in Los Angeles, and he says, "Are you sitting down?" And I said, "No, why?" He said, "Well, you better sit down." And I said, "Why?" "You've just been offered the lead in Stanley Kubrick's next film." I literally knew nothing about the fact that I didn't meet him. I didn't meet anybody. It just absolutely came out of the blue. Now, later on, I discovered that he obviously considered a lot of people, and he saw my film work, and I guess that was the reason. But that's how it happened.
Gary?
Well, my agent called me up, and he said, "Stanley Kubrick has offered you a second lead in his new film, 2001: A Space Odyssey." And I was a dyed-in-the-wool Kubrick fan. I had been since I was 15, and my first reaction to my agent was, "How much do we have to pay him?" I swear that's what I said. And so, needless to say, my agent thought that maybe I was kind of a rogue as a kid, rather wild. So my agent thought that maybe I should meet Stanley. So he set up a meeting. Stanley lived in New York, and I flew into New York and met Stanley at the Oak Bar at the Plaza Hotel. And Kubrick was a very cool guy. I knew he would be. And my first reaction to Kubrick was, I said, "Listen, I didn't set this up. My agency thought that, you know, we should have a contact, personal contact. I'm sorry about that. I'm sure, you know, I've already got the job. I don't really know why they wanted me to do it." And he just kind of looked at me. And I knew he would be cool. I've seen his films, and I just knew he would be cool. So we didn't even talk about the movie. Basically, truthfully, we talked about football. He was a big football fan. I know that upsets a lot of people who go to film and filming and study 2001 in college, but Kubrick was a great football fan.
Good to know. Well, so when you came on, you know, he and Arthur C. Clarke started this project in 1964, and Arthur C. Clarke and Kubrick were co-writing the book and the script simultaneously. And I'm curious, when you came on, what shape was the script in, and were you able to see all of the script or just your section?
Well, the interesting thing was that when I received the script, I started reading it, and something was somewhat familiar about it, and then it hit me. When I was 12, 13, and 14, I suddenly, I don't remember why, but I became a science fiction fan. And my mother used to give me a collection of the best of science fiction, probably from various sci-fi magazines, called The Best Science Fiction 1951, Best Science 52, 53. I'm giving away my age, but anyway. One of the stories was by Arthur C. Clarke. It was called The Sentinel, and it dealt with just the finding by the scientists of the monolith on the moon, and what it kind of suggested, that that some passing intelligence millions of years in the past were looking down on Earth, and now it was like a cosmic alarm clock waiting to go off by discovering it again. So that was my first reaction. Wow, that I would remember for that short story from age 12 or 13, whenever it was, that now I'd be doing this film based on it.
Gary?
Your reaction to the script?
Well, you know, it was sort of like at the top of the page, there'd be one sentence and nothing else the whole page. But, I mean, you know, believe me, I had such confidence in Kubrick, I didn't even consider it. But I did want to say this, that you said something about they got together in 64 and wrote the screenplay.
They started.
I tell you, truthfully, they walked around New York for a long time before that. They used to walk around Manhattan and talk about it, and then they'd go off. So it wasn't like what you've been reading. I know Stanley once told me that they had been in contact with it for a long period of time.
Getting onto the set, it was the aircraft manufacturer Vickers Armstrong that constructed that beautiful set of the spacecraft at a cost of $75,000, which was a lot at the time. Seems like nothing in retrospect. And you know, Gary, you're running on there, and it's pretty incredible. And I just want you to place us on the track with you running on that big, grand, beautiful hamster wheel of a set.
Well, I didn't have to eat any acorns or anything, but, you know, it was a piece of cake, really. I mean, there was nothing to it. When I ran all the way around, I didn't actually do that, you see. The camera was on a fixed position on the wheel, and the camera went like that, and I stayed at the bottom. So basically, the only time it was really difficult is there's one traveling shot where I'm running, and I'm sort of up a little bit, like here's the bottom of the wheel, and the camera was on wheels, and the guys were running, the grips and everything were pulling the camera, and I was trying to keep an equal distance to it. And so here's the bottom of the wheel, and the camera guys are up like this, and I'm up like that. And if you ever see the film again, you'll see that I'm actually running downhill, acting like I'm not running downhill.
Well, and then there's the amazing shot of the two of you together, where Keir's coming down the ladder. And
yeah, it's in one shot, in one frame, you see Gary eating upside down at the top of the wheel, and I enter in the hub and see him come down, get some food, and all in the same shot,
Right. Walk
upside down. Well, what they did, he had a harness underneath his. He was eating upside down.
So you were strapped in, Gary.
And they what they did was they revolved him down to me. I just walked, just as he did the running around, I just walked in place until he arrived, and I slid into the seat next to him.
By the way, you might be interested to know that that shot took about, close to a week?
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, the first time I was upside down and Stanley had a speaker system. He was outside with a helmet on. That was kind of funny. He had a helmet on in case something fell on him. But he was outside, and he said, in his gentle manner, as always, okay, Lockwood, on action, start eating. So I had these three sort of piles of nothing in front of me, and I stuck a fork in it. And you got to remember, I'm upside down, and the food went like this. And it was the biggest Rorschach test you've ever seen in your life. That was the end of filming for the day. We got to go back into London, and I think I stopped in Golders Green and got some fish.
Well, so I think it's a good time to talk about how many takes Kubrick would do when you're suspended upside down. How long would you be in the harness for?
You know, Shelley Long, an actress, I've never met her, but apparently she and Stanley didn't get along very well because constantly people come to our table, and we've done lectures on this movie all over the world, and there's all these books written about how many takes. The only time we really did a lot of takes was in the pod.
That's right? True.
Yeah, when Hal reads our lips. That's the only time we did a lot of takes. We did 35 takes. One day Stanley said, "You don't like to do a lot of takes, do you?" And I said, "I don't particularly like to, but you know, you're the boss. I'm here, I'm happy to be here, whatever you want." He said, "Well, why don't you like to do a lot of takes?" I said, "Because I think that after three or four takes that you start to get in a rut, that your mind goes to where you think it was before. and you start to think, okay, that was comfortable. I'll try to emulate that. You know, that's just my opinion, but we're all different.
I'll tell you another story that I think you might be interested in. I guess I'm showing off a little bit, but there was a scene that was where I speak to Mission Control, and we shot it, but in anticipation, it was technological gobbledygook for me. It was very hard to memorize, and there wasn't a lot of dialogue in this film to memorize, but this I was worried about it. So I spent weeks ahead of time, because I knew what the shooting schedule was, over and over and over again, so I could be relaxed when we had to do it, right? Well, we shot it. Then in editing it, Stanley decided it was too similar to another scene where Mission Control speaks to us. In fact, Mission Control speaks to us twice in the film. So he cut it. It was never used. But because of the way I memorized it, it's still there, and I can do the whole speech. I'll do it right now. It went like this.
Please.
Mission Control, this is X-ray Delta 1. At 1920 onboard fault prediction center, and our 9000 computers showed Alpha Echo 3-5 unit as possible failure within 48 hours. Request check your in-ship system simulator. Also confirm your approval our plan to go EVA and replace Alpha Echo 3-5 unit prior to failure. Mission Control, this is X-ray Delta 1. Transmission concluded.
Nice.
I've heard that thing so many times now, I think I can do it.
Now Gary can say it. You know, it's interesting you bring that up. I was going to bring it up later.
You should have heard him do it in Japanese and talk.
I had met you at Comic-Con a few years back and was talking about deleted scenes with you from the screenplay. And there was one that involved a piano. And there's a photo or two of you even with a piano on the spaceship.
Yeah, there was an electronic piano on the set, and I think they shot it, but it was never used.
So, Gary, tell us what it was.
May I make comment about that?
Please, please.
On Friday night, sometimes I would go with Stanley and see the Rushes, and we would have a steak and drink some wine. And I remember seeing that shot, and Keir had on these earphones, and it was sort of like an old player piano, you know, a roll of paper, and the notes are coming down, and Keir was kind of bobbing his head back and forth and playing piano, and the camera was very, very close to Keir. I mean, very close, and I don't remember what the lens was, maybe as wide as a 20 or something. And here's Keir bobbing his head like this. And I'm not putting you on. It was the greatest shot maybe I've ever seen in any movie in my life. And I'm looking at the screen, and I go, my God, that's unbelievable. Keir looked like a bug, you know, with the earphones on and everything. And I always loved that shot. So when the movie, when I saw it, it wasn't there.
Another thing that the audience might like to be amused by, anyway. Stanley had a hard time deciding what the voice of Hal should be, and originally he was thinking about Marty Balsam. Then he said no, to New York, and then he hired a wonderful British actor by the name of Nigel Davenport, who was on the set with us for a week or so, doing the lines of Hal off camera, obviously, and he said, "Now it's too English." So he said, "I'll worry about it in post-production after that's all the shooting's finished." So he just turned to his... The film was entirely filmed in England, north of London. And so he turned to his AD and said, "Derek, you do the voice of Hal for the boys." This was the voice of Hal for the rest of the film, which is most of it. Dive. Oh, no, I can't do that, Dave. Dicey, give me your answer. No, I was like working with Michael Caine.
You know, originally, I think it was before you guys came on, they were going to have Hal be Athena, a female voice, and they later used Sal, a female, in 2010. So was there ever any female iterations?
You know, an onion is, right? I mean, you peel it and you peel it, and pretty soon you say, "I'm never coming back to Outback Steakhouse." But anyway, I have a fan over there. Come and buy a Star Trek from me.
Well, so, you know, other lost scenes, I've always been curious if there was anything with Doctors Hunter, Kimball, and Kaminsky. Were there any scenes that involved you guys doing more with...
Just when they got redlined.
Okay, just the red line. Keir, on set, you were wearing a wig. And,
that's right.
And I'm curious about Kubrick's decision to have you wear a wig. Where did that come from?
You know, the only thing I could imagine, because I sort of forgotten why they... it could have been... It was a long shoot. We were there for a long time. And maybe he just didn't want to worry about matching the length of the hair. But that wasn't my... They changed my hair color. I was kind of a dirty blonde in reality. So that dark-colored hair was not... I don't know why. It's a good question.
I always had the feeling some of that was to control age, because Stuart Freeborn used to, remember, in makeup, he would put sometimes, if we were you know, young. I mean, if you see pictures of us at that time period, we were incredibly young. I mean, now I look like Bad Road, for Christ's sake. But, well, I don't look as bad as Tommy Lee Jones, but I'm getting there. Sorry, Tommy, he's a good actor, but... He looks like he's ready to die every time I see him.
I'll tell you what was... thank God I only had to do it once, but the oldest version, as I was aging at the end of the in that strange room, the oldest version on the bed reaching up to the monolith, that was 12 hours.
12 hours of makeup?
12 hour of makeup.
For head, arms, and hands?
Thank God he got it in one day.
You know, just out of sheer curiosity, because you're talking about that right now, did Kubrick give you any direction that was interesting about reaching your finger up towards the monolith? Because it's almost of like Da Vinci's, you know, God. Yeah, your finger. It's kind of God.
I don't
it's
recall.
The same thing the apes did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, that was the idea, was as Floyd, when he's standing in front of the monolith on the moon, also reaches up the same way, just as the apes did. And but I don't remember him kind of posing my hand in any particular way. He just asked me to reach up.
I'm curious, again, going back to the spacecraft, was it really hot in there, and were they able to record dialogue properly? Because I've always been curious if they were pumping in air conditioning, and then all your monitors were rear projections.
we
had tell them what happened to me.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. One day, Kubrick, everybody was in awe of Stanley, and no one ever, you know, said much to him. But I'm a bit of a troublemaker. So one time, I bantered with him on occasion. But one time, I'm standing like this. My arms are outstretched. I'm in that yellow spacesuit, and people are working on me. Stanley is sitting way up high with Johnny Alcott. And Alcott and I were friendly. And he later told me, he said, Stanley looked down, and I'm like this. And he said... He takes the microphone from John and he says, Lockwood, are you getting dressed or what? And I'll never forget, I went like this. I said, no, man, can't you see I'm taking a piano lesson? And he turned to Alcott and he said, sometime the surfer boy says funny stuff.
Was there any air conditioning in the suit? Or able to hear direction in the suit?
They just pumped air into us.
Okay.
We had these hoses with forced air that kind of helped a bit. It wasn't like air conditioning, however.
Were there speakers?
They were really hot, those seats.
Yeah.
Were there speakers so you could hear Stanley's direction from inside the suit?
He wouldn't necessarily speak to us while the shot was going, if that's what you mean, but he was able. He was the first director. Today, you know, the director never stands by the camera. But in those days, in the old days of filming, he always stood by the director always stood by the camera. Stanley, I think, was the first to use a monitor. Now everyone uses a monitor, but I'm quite sure he was the very first.
He was the first.
Yeah.
When you're in a film like this, and part of the journey that you're on is a revelation. Were there any things that were happening while you were on the Discovery in Space that were not revealed to you initially as actors that Stanley only wanted you to find out in the moment and were not provided to you previously in the script, kind of the way that that was the journey the astronauts were on, where they didn't know what was going to happen next.
Well, we had a script that we, I mean, we understood, you know.
I think that's the myth of Kubrick.
No,
I mean,
he didn't keep anything secret. We kind of were aware what was...
Yeah, we were pretty much aware of where it was going to go. But, I mean, you know, people like to write, you know, these books called Films and Filming, and you get a bunch of long-haired guys sitting together who... sorry, I had long hair once in a movie. But they get a little pretentious about talking about film. You know, it's pretty... even though it's a fantastic movie, there's a part of it that straight away, it's just flat out. Let me put it this way to you young people. Don't really go around saying you can make movies with your iPhone. I mean, you know, come on. I mean, that film had the greatest... There were lenses made by Panavision. That film is designed, and a great film is not an accident. Remember that.
Interestingly, one of the elements of the film was the acting that you were both required to do was at times as cold and calculated and logical as a computer. And I'm curious what kind of direction you remember getting from Kubrick about some of your very technical moments, but also the nonverbal acting that really carried for both of you in this film, which is not easy to pull off.
Well, you know, there wasn't a lot of direction, at least I don't remember a lot of direction that had to do with our emotional state from scene to scene. I have said recently, when I'm interviewed about the way he directed, great directors cast greatly.
Absolutely.
And if you cast greatly, you don't have to do a lot of direction. If you've got a great wardrobe person, there it is. If you've got a great writer writing the script, there it is. So when we were working, we had fictional bios. We were both had double doctorates, and we had discussed about how we had become astronauts, how they, as young people, maybe as teenagers, we were kind of watched and kind of... turned into a certain direction early in our lives. So, but the time. So actually, it was all there for us ahead of time. He kind of trusted us because he had cast well.
Keep in mind that when you make a movie, most of the time an actor is not speaking. You know, the difference would say a television show in 2001 is that a television show will have 50 or 60 setups a day. That means shots. A movie like 2001, there were days there were two shots or one shot. So it's one's an apple, one's an orange. But most of the time, if you cast, like Kira said, if you cast correctly, or if you cast something, a person's face or whatever, so that each time you're showing that image, your story's moving forward, as opposed to casting sort of like somebody with a huge mole like that and a green arm. He's not going to be Dave Bowman, you know what I'm saying? So Keir and I think we were cast because we looked like the possibility we could be young astronauts. And so the audience bought it.
You brought up earlier the great scene when you're talking in the pod and Hal is reading your lips. I'm curious if you could share with us what some of the things you were discussing when the sound goes out in the movie and you're still talking. Do you remember what you were talking about in those moments?
Well, the dialogue was written, but what was different about that scene than any other scene in the film was that Stanley felt that what was in the script was too long, and he wanted to make it more concise. So there was a lot of off time when we weren't filming because it took sometimes the shots would take hours to set up and light. And as Gary said, some of the shots, sometimes we only get one angle. That was it for the whole day because it was very difficult to light. So we had time off, and we would go, he would have us go to his office and record our improvisations. We would take what was in the script and try to make it more concise. Then he'd have that written up. Then we'd get the written up version that had been taken by a secretary and improvise on that. And it kept getting shorter and shorter. That was the only scene in the film where he did that with us. So what you saw and heard was result of improvising.
I can tell you this happened. One day Stanley asked me, he said, would you go over to the other stage and have a look to see? I was a stuntman as a young guy before I was an actor, so I was capable of body movement. And he said, would you go over and look at one of the space pods and see that when you get in, you don't look awkward? I understood that because, you know, movies, everybody's got to look like they're astronauts and be efficient. He said, see if you can get in the pod and not be awkward. So I went there and looked at it and thought, okay, yeah. So I came back and Stanley said, what'd you see? And I said, well, when we're in our spacesuits, it would have been awkward. So I had them build a handle like that. And if you recall, we put our hands up and we grabbed a hold of the handle and we walked our shoes, these big clodhopper shoes in, and then slid our Calipigianates into the seat, and we were there. And so when Stanley and we, there was a point one day where they were beginning to write a lot of scenes that were somewhat redundant, and that's the day that I said, you know, I kind of complained about a scene, and Stanley said, that's a wrap, and it was very early. And so I remember we stayed fit. So I'm up in my room doing Kier delays, Air Force exercises. Oh, God. And I'm in there running up and down like that. And Derek knocks on the door. And he says, hey, mate, Gov wants to see you. I said, hey, Eric, Derek, am I fired? He said, don't know. So... I was here, Stanley was here, and Kier was on the other side of Stanley. So I showered up, and I walked in, and I walked into Kubrick's room, and I said, hey, let me ask you something. I said, before we get into it, am I fired? He said, no. No, he said, no. You said, you've been a hardworking company man, so to speak, you were upset with the scene, weren't you? And I said, yeah, I just felt, you know, we were... I don't know. I just didn't feel it was up to the standard of what we've been doing. And there's got to be a better way. And he said, oh, well, you know, he said, on the way home, I'll have my driver drive you and he'll stop in Golders Green and get, you know, you like some of the food from the deli there, don't you? And I said, yeah, I do. He said, okay, well, have Eddie stop and get some food and you go home. And the next time I hear from you, let's see how you would solve the problem. So I went home, and I thought, oh, God, I put my foot into it. And so I got out a spiral notebook, and I wrote down all the possibilities of what I thought Stanley and Arthur were trying to solve as regards disconnection of the computer and whatnot. So I called Stanley about 9 o'clock that night, and I said, we can go in the pod, and we can have a conversation, and we can get everything out, and blah, blah, blah. And then later, we did all the improvs, remember? And then one day, there was a technical problem of how, indeed, would Hal get the information that we were going to disconnect him and all that. And Victor Linden walked in the room, and he was what was he? He was a production designer or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. He walked in the room, and he heard us say that, and he said, well, why can't he just bloody well read your lips? And that was from the pod to the thing, the long speech. And in that speech, we talk about everything, disconnection, and you, the audience, and get the information, and Kier and I are never aware that Hal has the information.
Ooh, hey, I'm cutting in really quick to remind you all about my digital magazine, Backstory. It's an iPad magazine that focuses on the art and business of storytelling. Currently, we're an iPad-only magazine, but fear not, we're coming to the web very soon. You could check www.backstory.net for updates. I know you've heard me say this before, but backstory.net really is going to go live this year, and I've even seen some proof of concept, and we have a lot of back-end stuff to figure out, so thanks for bearing with me. I cannot wait for you to see this. But if you have an iPad, you could check out issue 23, which we published today. You could check it out right now. It has our Snowden cover story. We have over 12,000 words for an in-depth look at what it took to make Snowden from three separate cover story articles on the film, which include co-writer Kieran Fitzgerald, actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and co-writer-director Oliver Stone. So you're going to love diving into our in-depth coverage of Snowden. In issue 23, we also interviewed iconic comic book writer Garth Ennis about creating his Preacher comic series. There's a TV piece with the co-writer of our new favorite show, Vice Principals. We interviewed the creators of an artificial intelligence computer program named Benjamin, and that AI program became a screenwriter to write a short film called Sunspring, and they gave us all the details about what it took to teach a computer to write a script. You can also read Zoe McCarthy's entire Blacklist script, Cut and Run, plus an interview with her all about it, and you could also read Billy Domeneu's utterly insane Seinfeld spec TV script, a what if they did a 9/11 episode called Twin Towers. It's a spec, obviously it was never made, but you could read that in crazy spec and an interview with Billy. And we've also got magician Derek Delgadio, who takes us behind his immersive one-man narrative-driven show at the Geffen. Plus, we've got plenty of current cinema as well, including Andrew Stanton on Finding Dory, Paul Feig and Katie Dippold on Ghostbusters, Taylor Sheridan on Hell or High Water, James Seamus on Indignation, plus the writers of Sausage Party, Star Trek Beyond, War Dogs, and more. So folks, don't miss this issue. I know you're going to dig it, and I can't wait to hear your feedback. Remember, if you have an iPad, the app and issue one are both still free, and each individual issue costs less than a beer at a hipster bar. So treat yourself. Look, I really appreciate all your help in spreading the word about and supporting my passion project. But now let's jump right back into this podcast hosted by the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship at a screening hosted by the American Cinematheque and the Beyond Fest as actors Keir DeLay and Gary Lockwood continue discussing their passion project, 2001, A Space Odyssey.
I'm curious, you guys have had the good fortune to work with a lot of different directors. What's something interesting that you've noticed about Kubrick's creative habits that kind of always stuck with you? The way he either interacted with you personally or with his crew?
Well, he's the most prepared director I ever worked with. If you take his whole career, he didn't make, numerically, didn't make that many films. He had probably 2.5 films per decade, something like that. And so he was, you knew you were in the presence of genius. I mean, I was a Kubrick, as Gary was, a Kubrick fan long before I worked with him, since I saw Paths of Glory, which was the first film that I saw. And I'll just illustrate, though, he had an eye for detail. Nothing got by him. But in the scene where Dr. Floyd, is stopped by the Russian scientist trying to find out what's really going on Earth, and of course he has a cover story that there's a disease that's creating problems, there are three women and plus a male, or four women and a male scientist, and the male scientist has most of the dialogue with Dr. Floyd, and in one of the angles, one of the women scientists that has no lines has a blue sweater over the back of her chair. When the camera comes around at another shot, the blue sweater is not there. It's a problem of continuity. The continuity person has forgotten to replace the sweater, the blue sweater. Well, if you listen very carefully, it's kind of muffled and very much in the background, there's a voice on a public address system during that scene that says, "A blue sweater has been found. Please go to the lost and found."
I swear to you, I heard that tonight in the beautiful theater.
Did
here?
You hear it?
It was so loud. First time I've ever heard that.
It's kind of distant and haunting.
Yeah. And I couldn't figure out what the hell that was about.
He obviously was editing the film and realized, my God, there's no sweater over there. So he added that only Stanley would have done that, you see.
All I was thinking was space sweater. Why?
You know, people who are big fans of Stanley Kubrick, sometimes they will say to me, I have one friend in California who has been, he's devoted his life to studying Kubrick. And he said, you know what I learned from Kubrick? And I said, no, David, what did you learn from Kubrick? He said, Kubrick said, making a film is nothing but solving problems. Really? Of course, that is. It's a technical medium.
Gary, really quick, were you in the suit when your character dies, or was it a stunt person?
Was I in the suit when I died?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, so that was a stunt person. I've always been curious.
No. I didn't make that much money on the film, but somebody a lot cheaper than me was.
Well, I'll give you an example where they couldn't use a stuntman, and it was a very complicated shot. When I'm blown into the emergency airlock, how that was shot was upside down. I mean, this was the only way they were going to. They dropped me three. It was almost three stories. They dropped me with one wire attached to, out of sight, because my body was between the camera and the wire, and I had to dive head first. And at the other end of the wire was a woven rope, which went sideways out of sight. There were the camera's down here, and the opening of the hatch to the from space is up there. And that's what I. The other end was a circus roustabout who had measured the drop several times, and he had tied huge knots in the rope that he could catch with these big gloved hands. So he's next to me, parallel, out of sight of the camera. I dive. He's up there waiting for the knot to reach his gloves. When it reaches his gloves, he jumps off his platform, and I go hurtling back up to the ceiling again. And then, as soon as his feet hit the ground, he lets go again, and I go hurtling back to the camera. He's waiting for another knot. And the reason they couldn't use a stuntman, if you remember, in the rush to try to save my buddy here, I have forgotten my helmet. Right. So it has to be my face. Thank God they did that in one take.
If they hadn't have done that, Cure Delay would have a 70 millimeter lens firmly in the middle of his head.
Well, as Noah Coward said, well, I was making Bunny Lake is Missing, and when I was introduced to him, what he said would have applied, and that is, Cure Delay and Gone Tomorrow.
You know, right before that is the iconic argument that you have with Hal. And it's interesting because the framing of it is a great shot on your face that's locked off, but you have a bright light in your eye. You have all the reflection of the monitors. And I'm just curious, you'd never blink. You never seemed to blink. How difficult was it to film that argument with Hal?
You mean when he won't let me in?
Yeah.
You know, that's acting. But
were you blinded? Were you able to see anything? Because there's so many lights on your face.
I don't remember not blinking. I wasn't told not to blink.
Okay.
You know.
You were just intense.
I was intense.
Talk about the disconnection of Hal. Because it's another beautiful scene. You're floating into it.
That is my favorite scene. It's not my favorite scene in the movie, but it's my favorite scene that I was in. Because I used my memory of a well-known play, or it was a film. First it was a play, and then it was made into a film called Of Mice and Men. And it's when the mentally retarded guy is going to be shot by his best friend because they're going to string him up because he's inadvertently killed a girl. And they have this dialogue throughout the film, his friend and the man have a dialogue, and he says, "Yeah, George, we're going to get chickens and we're going to get our own farm. Is that right, George?" "Yeah, that's right." And while that's going on, he will tell me, "George, repeat it again how it's going to be." And he has a gun behind his head, and of course he kills him but he keeps him without knowing. He wants to emotionally that he'll not know what's going to happen. So that, for me, when I take Hal apart, and I say, "Yeah, sing it, you know, Daisy, Daisy." That's what I used as an actor. That the memory of that of having seen that film.
The movie was budgeted at $6 million. It came in at 10.5, and it went overtime as well. How do you remember Kubrick reacting to some of the pressure of pursuing his singular vision? And probably getting a little bit of heat from MGM, I would think, or is that not the case?
I wasn't aware. I mean, well, you're probably right. But I
had a conversation with Stanley about that one evening at his home, and he asked me if I would fly back to California and knock on doors, because at MGM they were having a proxy fight as who was to control MGM, and it was going on as we were filming. And so, you know, no one really knew this, but I flew to California, went to MGM, all within a few hours, really, because it's a long flight. And I knocked on doors and said, would you please vote for those of us in London making 2001? And that's something that, you know, it's kind of, I'm writing my my biography right now, so there's more detail in that.
Great. We're going to take two from the crowd really quick. I saw your hand go up first, right there. What kind of human being did you find Kubrick to be? Was he cold?
He wasn't a tyrant at all. I mean, I loved every moment of working with him. He was low-key. He never raised his voice. I had just finished working with Otto Preminger, who was, I hate to say, was a swine. I mean, he was a bully, and he screamed and humiliated people. Well, Stanley was kind and quiet, and you just, as I said, you knew you were in the presence of genius, and you kind of reacted to that. But he was wonderful to work with, and you know the whole. You mentioned Shelley Long, who had some difficulty with him, but I think
they had a
in The Shining.
Out. Yeah, and she said a lot of things in print about Stanley being anal and Stanley being this and Stanley being difficult. And the reason I brought it up earlier is because people say that to me or to Keir at the table. And they're just misinformed. That's simply all there is. You know, don't believe everything you read. You know, sometimes the Yankees lose.
You know, as we're sold out tonight here at the American Cinematheque, I'm trying to look up in the balcony to see if there is anyone with their hand up there. His curiosity was, what does it feel to look back
that.
And know that
I
you were
that.
Part of one of the greatest films ever
it
made?
It is an extraordinary honor to be in a film that has received this kind of acclaim that we did. Well, Gary realized more than I did that this film might or would become an iconic film. You know, it's sort of like, would the actors who were in Citizen Kane, could they possibly know that they'd be studied in film school 80 years later, or however many years it was? And in my case, he was smarter than I was. I thought it was going to be...
I don't think that's the case. I think I'm not going to claim to be smarter than you. I mean, after all, you're the captain of the ship, you know. But the thank you. The point I want to make is that... I was an artist. I won a national art painting contest my senior in high school. I was a football player. I was a rogue. I was a bar fighter. I was a crazy kid. And I'm telling you, the one thing about me that was halfway honorable is that I loved movies and I liked to read books. So I wasn't totally stupid. And the first time I saw a Kubrick movie, I was 15 years old, down in Beverly Hills, California, in a little movie called, it was a movie house called The Fine Arts, and I came out of The Killing. And it's the first time...
Sterling Hayden.
And it was the first time I ever walked over. And, you know, it's in those little single movie houses. Now it's multiplex with every 5,000 kinds of candy and everything. But those little, you know, they'd have a kiosk and outdoors. And then you could get out of the rain. And then there was a poster by the kiosk. And I walked over and I looked to see who made the movie. Now... Flash, sometime later, I'll end the story with, I was playing football at UCLA, and we have these Santa Ana winds that come off the desert. And it's unbearable. Football's unbearable. I mean, I hated it. I liked the adulation, and I liked being a hero, but I hated the whole season. I mean, you're always hurt and sore, and it was terrible. But the point that it's true. It really is true. So the point I'm trying to make is that one day, the Santa Ana winds was like 105. Now, I lived in Malibu on the beach. And I get up that morning, and I go, oh, man, I got to go work out twice today in this. And I got the L.A. Times every day. I opened it up, and Paths of Glory is playing right here on this screen. So I go to training table that morning. You had to be there at 7:30. And I get my tray of food, and I turn, and all the coaches sat together, and they were all Southerners. And, you know, I, as a rogue, you can understand, I just walked up and said, Coach, I can't come to practice today. And they were all Southerners. And they, why can't you come to practice? What are you talking about? Blah, blah, blah. And I drove a Porsche. And I said, well, this summer I got a traffic ticket in San Luis Obispo for going too fast, and I have to be in court. This is the biggest lie. And a couple of my buddies knew the type of guy I was, so I walk over and sit down, and they go, you lying son of a... You're not going to San Luis Obispo. I said, yes, I am. And I held to my badge. I came up, parked at Grom's Chinese across the street, came over here. The first showing was like 11:30. So I walked up and down Hollywood Boulevard because it was early. And I saw the movie three times and then went back and had dinner.
Nice. You know, right here at the Egyptian. Everybody thinks of 2001 as this great classic, and it totally is. But at your premiere, 240 people walked out, including Rock Hudson. Your initial reviews were very mixed. There was confusion.
Absolutely.
What was it like for you as actors to go through that on this very important special project and have to wait for the world to catch up with you as to how
Frankly,
great it was?
I didn't give a damn.
Yeah, you're right about Rock Hudson walking out. He said, what is this BS all about? And walked out.
And Pauline Kael's initial review was
terrible review. Pauline Kael was.
And she rewrote.
One of the most famous screen critics of her era. But
yeah, but what are, you know, candidly, I'd like to just say this to all of you. And in my book, I get to talk about it because I don't have a job or career. I quit acting years ago. The point that I'm trying to make is, what critic has ever made a movie? I mean, they talk about great editing, crisp dialogue, fast-moving scenes. Come on, man. Did you ever see Miss Lonely Hearts?
Yes.
They just sent Monty Clift over to write the column.
I just tell you a little side story about the fact that MGM realized that a lot of people were seeing the film having smoked funny cigarettes.
And, yes, indeed.
Or LSD. So about two or three months after the initial opening of the film, they had this new poster come out. And the new poster... You remember what it is? Go ahead, you say it.
It said, the ultimate trip. But I was a California surfer boy, and I smoked a lot of pot in those days. And when I got out of the limousine in Washington at the premiere, I had smoked a joint, I can tell you. And it's kind of funny. And I got out, and some real slick guy had the microphone, and he said, oh, here's Gary Lockwood. He plays Frank Poole in the movie. Yeah, Mr. Lockwood. And he starts, you know, and he looked like a cartoon. He was so perfect. And I looked at him, and I'm kind of stoned, and I kind of look at him like, oh, man, check this guy out. And he said, so, Mr. Lockwood, he starts saying weird things to me about the movie. And I look at him, and I go, well, who told you that? What? Huh? And he finally says, well, Mr. Lockwood, it looks like you're still out there in space somewhere. And I said, wait, this is great. I looked at him and I said, well, man, you finally got something right.
You both have been very generous with your time. Thanks for being here tonight with us. Give it up for Keir and Gary. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Very special thanks again to today's podcast sponsor, the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship, which you can enter with your film or pilot television script at www.screencraft.org. And remember to make sure to get your submission in by January 15th, 2017. And hey, if you're listening to this podcast in the future, check out their site to see what other contests they're running. Also, a huge thanks goes to the American Cinematheque and the Beyond Fest for working their amazing magic to make this screening possible, and of course this podcast possible as well. And without a doubt, thanks again to Keir DeLay and Gary Lockwood for coming down to share their amazing experiences working on the classic film 2001, A Space Odyssey. This episode in the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2016. All rights reserved. And folks, I want to thank you again for spreading the word about issue 23 of Backstory on the iPad and letting folks know that Backstory.net will become the fully functional magazine quite soon. And hey, if you'd like to donate to this free podcast so I can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds for all my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.